Okay, anyway, let's pick up where we stand. It's world to do, and the year is flying by. I always say Purim is the end of the year. When I taught on a collegiate level here, I can tell you Purim was the end of the year. You understand? Then it's already Pesach, and everyone is planning and shmanning and what they're going to do, where they're going to go. Then after Pesach, I need not tell you, Shavuot is around the corner, the final exam, Smicha, Menachem already is breathing New York air, Washington Heights air, you don't know what you're in for. It's, but all right, you'll handle it. The last time I felt bad for someone going back to America, I don't want to mention his name, was a big Talmud Chacham, a Rosh Yeshiva, and we were with him about 30 years ago, his first minutes in America with his wife, and my wife and I were crying, Nebuch, Nebuch, Avram. This guy is going to go. Today he's more American than I am. You follow me, Menachem? I'll be very upset if that happens to you. That's all I can tell you. Gentlemen, today is, I've already said Divrei Musa Machshava, but I didn't start this shiur. Today is March 8th, 2015. It's Haintes Purim Magen Ezeis Givmei Nikol and Vafmei Reis. And only Yitzruben knows what I'm saying. But when we were, you see, Purim, it's a tremendous letdown, because every other holiday, Pesach is 4 to 8 days. Shavuot, I don't have to have Pesach is 7 days, but 8 days in Chutz Laaretz. Shavuot is 8 days or 9 days, Shmini Atzeret, right or wrong, Chutz Laaretz. Not Shavuot, Sukkot. Pesach and Sukkot, you have, Shavuot has no great happening to it. The only thing you can do in Shavuot is learn Torah. You have a lot of Torah to say this, but it's not important now. Sman matan Torah tainu. But Purim, you build up to a crescendo all in one day. Matonet lev yonim and Purim suda and shalach manat, and some people even drink a little. And then it's all over. So when we were kids, we had a ditty. Haint this Purim mug in his eyes. Give me a nickel and vach me a rice. Today is Purim, tomorrow it's not. Give me a nickel. Shows you a nickel was a tremendous amount of money, 5 cents, and throw me out. So Baruch Hashem, we've been thrown out. We're back to the normal world. At least Yerushalayim has the advantage. We have 2 days of Purim. Purim, Shushan, Purim, you warm up. Now, we spent last week on the whole question of Erev, essentially going into Melbourne, going into Australia, going into Chabad, and as I showed you, a letter from the Rebbe had a special approach. We're going to see that there was another great Rav who had the same approach, but the Rebbe had the approach that he was opposed to Eruvin. Nevertheless, he felt if you want to build it clandestinely, quietly, go ahead and do it, but don't publicize it. That way people who will carry on Shabbos will not be doing an Issa D'oraita, you'll minimize the Issa involved. Yes, Yitzchak.
Is it possible to read that differently, that he really was for it, not that he was opposed?
No,
because if he said do it clandestinely, that means...
What you're saying, Yitzchak, is absolutely correct. It means halachically, the Rebbe evidently felt yesh al mi l'smoch, that those who want to build an Eruv, remember this is an insoluble machloket. If you want to worry about 16 amot, what's tetzayin amot, tetzayin, yeah, 16 amot wide, then you're going to have a reshut to rabban problem almost everywhere. If you're going to worry about 600,000, then you probably will have a reshut to rabban problem very rarely. And if you take the point of view like the Chazon Ish, that omed merubala parutz because of all the big buildings and houses, then you're not going to have a problem anywhere. And how do you go with 600,000? Do you count the cars? Don't you count the cars? So, yesh, Litzarev snifim, and this is what Heter Erev is built upon. When we say Heter Erev, we mean it's Surat HaPetach. Of course, if you're going to build fences and walls and doors, then there's no problem. So it meant that what the Rebbe is saying is essentially like the Mishnah Berurah. And the Mishnah Berurah said, Bal Nefesh Yachmir, but if you wish, you can be Samach on the Erev. And that's what the Mishnah Berurah passed in La Halacha. Now, The Rebbe, when he says to do it quietly, because he was worried about other problems, that kids will grow up like kids growing up in the state of Israel. Do the kids really know that it is forbidden to carry on Shabbos? Everyone takes for granted. You grow up with an Erev. It takes a good Rebbe, a good Talmud Chacham, a good teacher, to instill within youngsters growing up in the state of Israel that Hotzah is one of the Lamed Tet Melacha. It's a Melacha Gruer. Tosfos calls it that. And we can go into all types of philosophical analyses, and I've done it over the years. Those of you familiar with Rav Hirsch's point of view, what does it mean, Hotzah? Rav Hirsch has a brilliant, brilliant philosophic analysis. Right, you can spend many shiurim on it. But halacha l'maisa, a kid growing up in Bayit Vagan never had one Shabbat when he couldn't carry. So the Rebbe was worried about that, and more importantly, he was worried about logistics, where there is an Erev, what happens if the Erev is knocked down, how will people stop carrying, everyone is used to carrying, how will you inform people, how do you inform them on Shabbos? And the Rebbe was bothered by all these secondary issues. Now, I have to tell you, we'll see in a minute, I don't want to wave away what Yitzchak said, you'll see why in a minute or two. And I ended off the class last week, and I showed you Chabad, and you have to understand, Chabad is a master of publicity. No one but no one has the ability. You look at the websites, you look what Chabad is doing, you look what Chabad publishes. And nowadays, when you talk about a kinus of shluchim, of shluchat, literally, you can be thousands and thousands of miles away from 770 East Parkway, and you can be right there at the kinus. You can hear all the speeches, you can see all the people, the pictures are endless. The video, the Chabad is a master of modern technology. What we lack, well, you take Yeshiva University, people ask me, can we see your shirim? Are there videos of your shirim? I say, you're lucky that YU was able to put the audios up. Baruch Hashem, beyond that, YU does not have anything. Chabad is an absolute master. So here you have beautiful publicity from this very year, where Chabadnikim, obviously Chabadnikim, are being Seicha, the Rishut, from Brooklyn's new borough president. Here you see an Afro-American, I think he has the biggest smile, more than all the four Chabadnikim standing next to him. He's the happiest guy alive. This is tremendous publicity, an Afro-American cooperating, accepting, what is it, Lincoln, what did you tell me? It was a $5 bill, a $10 bill? Lincoln. $5 bill. Accepting a $5 bill from the Chabadnikim, he couldn't get better for a politician. He couldn't get better publicity. But now I want to pick up where I left off last week. This very little act that I described to you briefly, a minor act, right or wrong, he's leading the way, right? He's renting to them, he's doing Chabadnikim. You have no idea how much discussion this little act engendered. And when you touch upon the issue of Erev, you are getting involved with Chabad, with fundamental questions. What is Torah all about? Now, I cannot tell you how much correspondence came in to me on this very topic. And I apologize to all those who corresponded. I'm only going to quote a little bit. But what I'm quoting is Mir Tamangzik et Tamarimba. Now, coming back to Melbourne, what I told you last week was essentially correct. Rabbi Levin, I don't know how he pronounced it, I met him, I was very impressed with him, as I told you, a fine Talmud Chacham, it was a pleasure to speak with him, Bucky in the Achronim, he knew Rabbi Ovadia and Rabbi Moshe and the Tzitz Eliezer. He's in a very similar world to the world that Baruch Hashem, I swim in. And here's the story of that kollel. Officially, the head of the kollel was Rabbi Chaim Gutnick. I thank Yitz Gold from Australia who spelled it out for me. Rabbi Chaim Gutnick Zecher Tzadik Levracha was the father of all the Gutnik brothers. He was an elder rabbi in Australia, if I'm not mistaken. He was there already in the 1920s, the 1930s. He was a Chabadnik from the old school and a very polished, fine gentleman rabbi in Australia. He was the official head of this kollel that his son Yasala established and financed the whole kollel. In reality, he gave a shir a week. Rabbi Levin was the Rosh Kollel on the ground. It was much the same way in Gris Kollel. All the years that Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein was active, Rabbi Aaron was listed as the Rosh Kollel, and Rabbi David Miller was listed as the Skan Rosh Kollel. In reality, Rabbi Aaron gave one shir a week, and that was it. Rabbi David ran the Kollel on a daily, hourly, minute-to-minute basis. And that's the way the kollel worked. Now, the rabbi whose writings I quoted all about, the wrote so brilliantly on the Erev issue, his name is pronounced Krasniansky. I kept on Krasniansky. Now, with this rabbi, Feitel Levin, so here you have a Chabadnik, here you have someone who is dedicated to following the Rebbe, and here he is the one who rebuilt the Erev in Melbourne. And here's the story on that from someone I depend upon. I met him personally this past February, Rabbi Chesky Edelman from Olympia, Washington. My brother Mendy did his smicha under Rabbi Feitel Levin in Melbourne. He told me that while having a discussion with him, Rabbi Levin received a call about making an Erev in another community. Rabbi Levin responded that he does not make community Eruvim. The caller asked him why he did the one in Melbourne. Rabbi Levin responded that he worked with the Melbourne Erev because he was asked about the kashrut of it and eventually parceled it. He said that if he parceled it, it is his responsibility to make it kosher. Even though he doesn't want to make community a riven, if there's one in town, it has to be a kosher Erev. Now, and this is more or less my perception of what happened in Australia. I think I'm absolutely right. Rabbi David Groner could not make an Erev. He was very close to the Rebbe. He was from a different generation. We've spoken about the Groner family on Monday. But later, when the Mizrahi element and other elements in the community put up an Erev, and you have a Rabbi Levin heading up the Kollel and a first-rate Talmud Chacham at him, and he's not happy with the Erev, again, well, I don't know what the problems were, but I would imagine there were problems with Surah Kapetach, and he felt an obligation to correct what was. And here I showed you in Brooklyn that they're renting out Chabadnikim and Erev publicity. And now you get involved with unbelievable questions. No, what's the Rebbe's opinion? And more than that, how can a chassid of a Chabadnik build an Erev, be involved in Schirat Rishus, go public if the Rebbe was opposed? Even if the Rebbe was willing to let an Erev be built, and even if the Rebbe held, as Rabbi Rubin said, and I believe Rabbi Rubin is correct, that Me'ika Hadin Yesh on Midle Smoke, otherwise the Rebbe would have never said, build it clandestinely, build it quietly, build it secretly. Yesh on Midle Smoke. But now you're going and doing it. Bifnei Am V'Eda? How can a Chabadnik do that? And that raises an entire question. Can we do things differently than our Rebbe? For a Chassid, this is a much more difficult question than a Litvak. Because in the Litvisha world, there was, if you know anything about the Luzhin, there was dafka an environment that ultimately encouraged individuality. You look at Volozhin and you take the outstanding students, there are almost no two that thought alike. Volozhin produced Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. Rabbi Elchanan produced Rabbi Avner Yitzchak, a Kohen cook. Volozhin, well, let's talk about the great Rabbanim, that there were people who...
Well, it was smart one, because the Russians wouldn't let any of the Jews go into college.
No, so the Volozhin was their college. But Volozhin produced Rabbi Moshe Mordechai Epstein. Volozhin, you talk about the Levish Mordechai, you talk about Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, you're talking the Evin HaEzel. And the Levush Mordechai, the Rabbi Zalman Meltzer, were brothers-in-law. And they were tremendous. Ohavei Tzion. They came on Aliyah when it wasn't fashionable. Just think for a moment. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer came in the early 20s. The Levush Mordechai came when they opened the branch of Chevron a year or two later. In Chevron, I mean, imagine to come to Chevron in the 1920s, you had to be a tremendous, tremendous Zionist in the full sense of the word. Ohev Eretz Yisrael in the full sense of the word. And the Volozhin, Reikers Volozhin. I can tell you, we studied with the Rav. So I've told you so many times, the Rav got angry when you mimicked him. And he used to say time and again in the classroom, tut nicht was ich tut, sondern ich tu das. Don't do what I'm doing because I do it. Only emulate me if you think I'm right. And in the Rav's world, time and again, he would come up, he would give his shear and reach a certain decision, a certain conclusion. And then you would say, Rebbe, so should I sit during Havdalah? Or should I stand during Havdalah? Should I sit during Kiddush? Or should I stand during Kiddush? And the Rav would answer, Was hat euer Tate getan? What did your father do? Do what your father did. See, in a Hasidic world, it's much more Rebbe-oriented, much more Rebbe-centered. So you can have a guy like Rakefet. Rakefet is the Talmud of the Rav. You'll ask Rakefet, do you do everything like the Rav? No. And I've told you more than once over the decades, what I saw Rebbe do with my own eyes, I do like the Rav. What I know Rebbe did, but I didn't see with my own eyes, I have freedom of choice. And I'll give you a very simple example. Pesach is coming. Nu, Yomo, how many matzah do you take Leil HaSeder? To take 3 matzah is absolutely nonsensical. If there's a din of lechem only, then the broken matzah has to be one of the lechem mishnah. You have to break what's the kiyum of lechem mishnah. It's the gong. The Rav took 2 matzah. He broke one of the matzah, lechem only. We take 3 matzah. I was taught, you were taught in kindergarten, Kohen, Levi, Yisrael, whatever they taught you, whatever nourishment they taught you, Torah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, please, fairy tales out of kindergarten. But I take 3 matzah. Why? Because my father took 3 matzah, my grandfather took 3 matzah, I was taught in kindergarten, take 3 matzah. When I taught in Talmud Torah, I taught them Kohen Levi Yisrael, but I apologize. Now you feel a little better, Alex. But for how much that comment, please.
I mean, I'm pretty sure that
please.
I'm pretty sure they're real
convenient. No, the reason is, you want to know why you take 3? Because no Jew had the heart to break up Lechem Mishnah. Plain and simple. Lechem Mishnah is Lechem Mishnah. I Pesach night, there's a din in Lechem only, you follow me, Medafkei Medlamdis. But which Jew could break a matzah in half? So that's why they round up 2 matzah for Lechem Mishnah. And a 3rd matzah to break in half. And that matzah, you turn into the Afikomen, you get the kids and you follow it, so you gotta go. But I take 3, I do like Yomo. I the Rav took 2. Say that if I had been at the Rav Seder and saw the Rav take 2, it would be hard for me to take 3. But since I know intellectually what the Rav did, but what can I do? I grew up with 3, everyone takes 3. I take freedom. You follow? And but a chassid lives to ape the Rebbe, to mimic the Rebbe, et tut nachvi the Rebbe. It's part of chassidus, it's part of the whole concept of belonging, of being part, enash, anshei shlomeinu. It's a club, it's a very unique, sophisticated club. And I want to be a member of the club. And in order to be a member, I do like every other member of the club and all the members of the club, our eyes are focused on the Rebbe. And this is chassidus. Ah, so you see, if Rakefet builds a Neirav and carries and is willing, and the Rav, he'll meet the Rav, and he knows that Rakefet now knows a little bit how to learn, and he can talk and learn it with his Rebbe. That's the tragedy of life. It's an open Gemara, it's in heaven. You understand? When I learned with the Rav, I knew nothing. So I couldn't talk with him on a level. In 1978, I spent the Shabbos with the Rav. Then we spent hours talking and learning on a level. But what I know today, if I would meet the Rav, what can I tell you? We're lost. But I would say to Rebbe, yeah, I know you're machmir like the Mishkan Okanak. Well, Rebbe, what do you say about the Bet Ephraim? What do you say about the Chazon Ish? What do you say? And you bring that all the shitat. And Rebbe, Reb Moshe is a shita d'chuya, is a shita yechidit. Reb Moshe has viewpoints, even Reb Moshe admits that he had very unique, extreme viewpoints in relation to Eruv, that if there's that one place in the city that leads into another place, leads into another, that place, there's 600,000, the whole city already has a din of city, you can't build an Eruv anywhere, etc., etc., etc. But the Rebbe and the cause for Shush HaYachid, all right, so we would start talking and learning, being mafalpil and arguing back and forth, but a Talmud in a Litvish atmosphere has more flexibility, let me put it that way. He can move away from his Rebbe and still be a good Talmud. You want another example? Menachem, here, I'll give you an irrefutable example of giants now, not little guys like Rakefet. Giants. Here, Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. Menachem, where were you born?
Here.
Where were you born? Where?
In Hatzin.
And when did you come in Aliyah? How old were you?
Four
years old. You grew up in Israel. How many days Yontif have you observed since your bar mitzvah? One day Yontif, right or wrong? Absolutely. Where are you living? You're living in Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Now you're going to go to America. You're going to study in YU. How many years ahead of you there? Are you married? Are you married? You're married. So you're going with a wife. That makes the problem even worse. And you're there for three regalim. One day, a day and a half, 2 days. What are you going to do in Washington Heights next Sukkot and next Pesach? Let me hear. What, you're telling me you don't know? You don't know? Believe me, you don't know. And whatever you do, you're wrong and right at the same time. You can't be wrong, you can't be right. You're finished. There's no solution to this problem. It's brachot levatala. No matter which way you quetch and turn, I'm going to be Shavuot in Stamford, Connecticut. Can you tell me what I'm going to do on Shavuot? Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, a 3-day festival. Okay? I'm going to do exactly what my Talmud Rabbi Danny Cohn is doing, except one little addition. You know what that addition is, right? On Monday, after davening and after kiddush, I'm going to sneak away, excuse myself, go into a sealed room, put on tefillin without a bracha, make a deal with Ribbono Shleilim, if it's chol, these are tefillin, if it's yontif, and there's an oath of kedushat hayom, then these are kishut b'yalma, I'm putting on jewelry, and I'll say kriyat shema, I shouldn't be made an eved sheka, okay? Now, you all know this is a tremendous machloket. You all know a dummy in Gris Kolel before some of you guys, before you were, most of you were born. A guy named Rakefet gave a year and a half, or 2 years worth, who knows already, of Sheyurim on Yontif Sheni Shel Galus. All right? It's a very fascinating topic, believe me. So, Baruch Hashem, I know the topic. So now we'll talk about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. I asked the Rav, 1978. Rebbe, is it true what you say that in Eretz Yisrael it's one day, America 2 days? And the Rav says, my tata is my phone. Can I speak Yiddish? Or
why not?
Why not? Because Alex, Mama Lashem, English. I want to be understood.
I wish I could understand.
By Alex and Rafi. Alex, when I listen to the Rebbe, I don't need the earphones. You understand? The last Yotet Kislev I went to at Binyanei Huma, there were 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people sitting there. There was only one person without earphones on. Yours truly. And I asked the guy next to me, he's hearing the Rebbe in Hebrew, and this dummy is hearing the Rebbe in English. You follow? And I'm the only one sitting there who's actually hearing the Rebbe, not hearing some two-bit translation as the Rebbe speaks. Sam, I want to ask a serious question. What did the Rav say? So the Rav tells me, I asked this very question that you're asking me. I asked my father of Moshe in 1935 when I was going to Israel. Then I didn't have the problem with Malacha because Shavuos fell Friday, Saturday. But how do I daven Shabbos? And my father told me, I daven like an Israeli. And my father quoted his father, Reb Chaim, that the Chacham Tzvi has never been refuted. You follow? Chacham Tzvi said, in all of Shas, we all know that Jews came from Babylonia to spend Yontif in Eretz Yisrael, Aliyah L'Regel. We know that this affects the Tein Talumata when you start, you know, the blessing, when you start the request, I should say, not just mentioning God's Gevurah, but making the Bakasha. And that's why in Israel we delay till the people should go back. And yet there's not one mention that anyone observed 2 days in Eretz Yisrael. You follow? So, and Rav Chaim held like the Chacham Tzvi, the Chazon Ish held like the Chacham Tzvi, Rav Ovadia Yosef held like the Chacham Tzvi, the Minchat Lazer held like the Chacham Tzvi. It was unbelievable here. Our big problem is, evidently, the Shulchan Aruch didn't hold like the Chacham Tzvi. So, all right. So, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein would Paskin like the Rav? Rav Heschel Schechter, I don't know, I would imagine also, growing up, we all knew the Rav spoke about it in public a number of times. Who would have the chutzpah to question a psak of the Rav in the name of Rav Meisher, in the name of Rav Chaim Briska? No? What is Rav Heschel Paskin today? What is Rav Aaron Paskin today? Paskin's Eretz Yisrael, you're from Chutz Laretz? 2 days. 2 days. Eretz Yisrael, you're now, you go to Chutz Laretz, and you're at Washington Heights. Well, Menachem has more of a problem if he's there with his wife and 3 regalim, the Aruch HaShulchan, you'll see. But if you're in Eretz Yisrael, I once walked into the Young Israel of Bucharest on Yom Tov Sheni of Pesach, and everyone jumped on me, oh, Baruch Hashem, you're here, turn on the lights for us. He forgot to tell the custodian to turn the lights on. I said, you got the wrong person. I was in a hotel. I once did a friend of mine a favor, needed a Scotland residence in, you know, one of these eating feasts. I'll never forget that hotel, the food. You couldn't walk Dalaramo wherever you walked. There were potato chips. There were chocolate-covered candies. It was unbelievable. 8, 9, pure Olam Hazeh. You would need
three. You didn't taste anything?
I didn't what?
You didn't taste them?
How much can you taste? Ribani Shalalam. You need 2 stomachs for those affairs. So people came over to look at me. Rabbanim, you're actually observing 2 full days? I said, yes, the Rav's Psak. They looked at me like a relic. They couldn't believe it. Anyone does it? Nowadays, Rav Heschel Schechter, although by Rav Heschel, he contradicted himself. He passed in both ways. There's a famous story. You can check the internet, type in Rabbi Heschel Schechter, Yom Tov Sheni, you'll get the story with Los Angeles. So he, but Rav Aaron Lichtenstein totally changed. 2 full days in Eretz Yisrael, 1 day in America. Again, I'm not passing malacha, even when you say 1 day, but you're not allowed to do malacha in front of other people, you know what I'm saying, etc., etc., look into the Shulchan Aruch. But I asked Rav Aaron, he told me he became very close to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach. and he spoke about this topic in great depth with Rav Shlomo Zalman, and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach took the opinion that it has to do with the community you belong to, not where your feet are. You follow me, Adam? It's not like Kriyat HaMegillah. Kriyat HaMegillah, I have a grandson in the Gush, so he observed Thursday, and then he went to his Rebbe's house in Kfar Maimon, and the yeshiva hired a bus from Kfar Maimon to take them back to the Gush, and from the Gush to Yerushalayim, those who wanted to go. So he's now on the bus to Yerushalayim, and my grandson is laning the Megillah. So I asked him, why are you laning? Why did you lane? He's exhausted. It wasn't easy to lane on a bus, but there were people on the bus, and the bus driver, everyone kissed him and thanked him. And he's a Balkori. There's a kid who can get up and lane Kola Torah Kula on the second's notice, Kanayin Hara. So he's a good kid. Believe me, I wish I had some of his abilities, but that's the way the ball bounces. The Chatam Sofer used to say, would give away, what was it? He said a 60th of his learning or a 10th of his learning if he could only have a good voice. So what can I say? The Chatam Sofer had to give away. I don't have too much to give away, so I'm happy without a voice as long as I can keep learning. You follow me? You follow me, Rafi? So I asked my grandson, why are you laning? He said, because we're sleeping over in Yerushalayim, and if you sleep and wake up, you know, I said, yeah, that's Mikadin. I said, did you make brachot? He said, no. Because see, it's a big problem. How can you have 2 days Purim? In other words, Yomo was Thursday in Kerem Biavna, and Friday he's in Yerushalayim. And no, 2 full days? But you see, Meik, it's a shmuas among achronim. But logically, it's correct. You can only have 1 day Purim. The first day that comes along is your real Purim. After that, it's hard to say you have a chiyuv involving brachot. So the nohag is that they do mitzvah tayom, kriyat megillah, shalach manis, sudat Purim, matonat levyonim. Drink a drop of we all drank a little wine together Friday morning till we had our suda with my grandchildren. I was very proud of them. No one got drunk. So we all drank a little wine, but if you observed already Thursday, you don't make brachot on Friday. All right, halacha lemaisa. See, but Rabbaran changed his mind. I can't tell off. Rabbaran from Rav Lichtenstein, you understand? When I was a kid in the Rebbe's class, he was our idol. Everyone looked up to him. He was bucking in Shas already. It was unbelievable. But Rav Shechter, I said to Rav Shechter, I said, Heshi, how do you pass him this way? You know what the Rav held. He looks at me, his very beautiful blonde, he was a blonde kid, you know, that I still see him as a youngster, and I said, yeah, I understand already, you have a mind of your own at your age. And he said, correct.
You're saying the pshat for both of them is that just after years of learning when they got older, they just disagreed with the rabbi.
Right, they just plain and simple, Rav Aaron told me. So you see, for a litvak it's easier, but for a chassid it is infinitely harder. Now, this raises tremendous issues, which I can go on for hours, and so much material came in, but I just want to scratch the surface, because this is an issue that can occupy your thought from now for the next 120 years. Tell me, can a chassid really change what a Rebbe ruled? More than that, imagine you say, times have changed. Can a Torah Jew say times have changed? This is a very delicate issue. And let's analyze it right down the line. Times have changed? What does that mean, times have changed? Well, what do we suffer today? The feminist issue. Partnership, what they call partnership minyanim, right? Is that the term they use? Or partnership prayer groups? I gave them this kola. I spent months going through the partnership minyanim, going through their entire halachic framework and everything they said. Years ago when I dealt with feminism. Everything is on YU, absolutely. I spent the whole year on feminism. Times have changed. And no, this is a very serious question. Tell me, I just got a very difficult shaila. Did I tell you a shaila dealing with dinei yishut and dealing with the trufa, with medicine? And I told the person asking me, hold on, I don't want to paskin this. You call my talmidah, Dr. Dina Zimmerman, Dr. Dina Cohen Zimmerman. She was one of the, she was with the first group that became Yotzat. She's a medical doctor. She's married to a student who studied with us in this kollel, Sammy Zimmerman, Rabbi Sammy Zimmerman. And I said, you call Dina, tell her I told you to call, and call me back and let me know what she answers. And it was fabulous. She dealt with it, dealt with the medical issue, and explained everything and said what she would paskin, and I signed on the dotted line. No, I want to ask you a question. Did the Rav ever call a yoetzet halakha to paskin a difficult question involving dini ishut, intimacy, and dealing with medical issues? I don't know. So, times have changed.
No.
So, do we have a right to get women involved in psak? You understand? Obviously, I feel we do. Have times changed? What do you mean times have changed? What is the limit? How far can you go?
Just because of her expertise as being a doctor.
And halacha. Don't leave out the halachic aspect of it.
Right, but you could have easily called a posek who had similar expertise.
I could have easily called David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom. That's why I would have called 12, 13 years ago, Hashem Yikom Damo. But now I can call a woman. She published an article in Tradition. Dean is the very delicate issue. Let's go a step further. You now have women representing people in the Batei Din, not as secular lawyers, but as Toanot Rabbanim, women who are experts in Hilchat Koshin Mishpat and Hilchat Devanessa.
That's as per Avi Weiss.
You see the problem? Well, then someone is going to say, so, all right, Rakefet, you're willing to accept your atzat. Your daughter was the first to win it. What's wrong with partnership minyanim? And you know how far they've gone. When I analyzed it, I'm told it's gone further. They had a woman leading Lechad Dodi, had a woman leading Psukei de Zimra. Now I'm told... Laning is the least of the problems. The davening is worse, and much more of a problem. And now I'm told they have a woman leading Mariv because they came up with a tshuva that Mariv is Rishut and not Chobah. And the answer is, and a Talmud, I have among the leaders of this new movement on my own Talmidim, and one Talmud said to me with Derek Harris, but said to me, smacked my face and said, Rebbe, you have to get used, just as you've gotten used to women learning Gemara, you have to get used to women davening Fama'amid. Quote, well, unquote. What
I suppose they said that's also
Alex, what I want you to understand, this times have changed. Feminism, homosexuality. Did we ever dream when we were growing up, Hashem Yirachem, I heard the Rav, you can hear him on tape, where the Rav goes crazy, this is the early 70s, that we're going to come along and say we're in favor of homosexual marriages, all right, we can't do it halachically yet, but this is what my own Talmidim, I don't want to mention their names and who they are today, this is what they said to me word by word. Times have changed. No? What does it mean times have changed? Okay. Do you understand what I'm saying? On this issue, we can spend the next 70 years and try to develop. You just saw in Tradition, the Trimmer brothers did a masterful piece of work on partnership minyanim, right or wrong. Did you see the latest Tradition? They're already latest to the editor, questioning this, questioning that. I don't have to tell you how much went back and forth on the internet on these very issues. So you see, times have changed. Now, imagine people are going to say, yes, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was opposed to building an Erev. He gave many valid reasons why. But times have changed. Okay? this comes up. What I find very interesting about the websites, and I sent my students, David Katz, Rabbi David Katz, who works for Satmar. I have students on every side of the spectrum, though. He works for Satmar. He's been written up in, I think, Ami magazine, maybe Bamishpacha. He's been written up. I've been written up, too, but when they wrote me up in Ami, they threw dots at me. You saw that. But Baruch Hashem, David is written up with respect. He taught me in this very kollel how to turn a computer on, how to reach the New York Yankee website, how I can be a kid again, Baruch Hashem. So one thing is fascinating. When you have an article, you have what they call bloggers afterwards, opinions and comments. Am I using the right word? They blog in, bloggers, dove. Is that the right word? Tell me, Nu, correct me if I'm wrong. But I find it very interesting. So here, on this very release of the Erev, you have a world of comment. I understand the Rebbe was not in favor of having an Erev, but times have changed. You cannot imagine what a fire, a conflagration, this little blogger caused. You're right, I understand the Rebbe was not in favor of having an Erev, but times have changed? Really? Is this how we should live our lives? All the things the Rebbe spoke about, and for that matter, many halachot also were for times gone by. But now we live in the 21st century? Is this the new way? And hold on, Yitzchak. We don't need.
I want to say, yes. Rabbi Hirsch, in the 1800s, has the most strong argument.
Wait. From the 1800s, right?
Because he writes that what was the whole focus of Kanaka? The Messiavim against the loyalists against the Messiavim.
Right.
And so therefore, how did he put Moses' take? That the Yavim said times have changed.
Right.
And the loyalists said, So in other words, we have a serious problem.
Well, some things
maybe, it's not a matter of times have changed. You have women who are Yodea, and they made a shimon between medicine and halacha. You can go to them like you go to any other expert. But there's a far cry, and a woman wants to learn the lower, and be shown this is beautiful. But to stand to the omen, and they give it to Malachi that it's Ushus and it's not Koba. Now there is what you use the terms consensus. If I take Rabbi Yossi Aglili and say, well, chicken is really alike, there's a consensus.
Chicken and milk.
Chicken and milk. So 2,000 years we have a consensus, it's meat. 2,000 years we have a consensus, we don't admire it. I would like to find anybody today tell me it's Ushus.
But it's also there's a deeper problem being addressed there, which is you're attacking on the micro level. All these things attack on the micro level. It's the macro level that's off. Their whole understanding of the theological system is off, and it's motivated by absolutely wrong ideology.
It's motivated by what we would consider.
I'm not just talking about feminism. It's the entire. That's just one piece of it. It's the entire outlook.
Believe me, you're absolutely right. And if I can quote Rakefet again, we all paint a picture that's unique to us, but the framework of the picture is the same for all of us. Dvar Hashem zu halacha. But these are the real problems.
Right,
what's amazing?
But what's amazing is from one
little publicity release, it opens a Pandora's box. Now, here is something very fascinating. Someone writes in and he goes through the Rebbe's position and how the Rebbe really is quoting you, Yitzchak, that the Rebbe really wasn't opposed to Erev. The fact was he said, make it, but make it quietly, because the Rebbe had other fears. And one of the main fears was that if the Erev breaks down, people will not know about it. The fact is, times have changed. Nearly every major Jewish community today has an Erev, so people are already used to it. And the modern standard for a Reuven that has emerged since the Rebbe wrote that letter is that a Reuven are checked every week. The status is published. People are told not to rely upon the Erev until they have verified that it is up that week. We also have many channels of communication that didn't exist in the 1950s. Email, Twitter, websites, and recorded messages on telephone lines. In the 1950s, many people had no phone at home. Today, everyone, outside of Rakefet, has one in his pocket. But listen to this paragraph. Incidentally, not every Erev will inevitably fail. The Melbourne Erev has been up for over 15 years, checked every week, and has never once been found to be pasul. In principle, it may happen one day, which is why it's still checked every week, but it seems very unlikely. And you see, gentlemen, this concept with the Erev, as time marches on, we become more expert on building an Erev, we get more cooperation from the electric company, from the phone company, from the local municipality. Originally, when you came to them with the idea that the Erev should be part of an existing infrastructure, they were frightened. What will it do? Will it harm? Will it cause wear and tear? And 10, 15, 20 years later, it goes hand in hand. There's no problem. No one has ever suffered from an Erev. No truck has ever knocked an Erev over. If trucks do not knock over electric poles and telegraph wires and telephone wires and all that goes into modernity, trucks do not knock over a Erevim as well. So that's a very interesting point, which here already you can say it's not that times have changed, but the reality on the ground has changed. And that fear of the Rebbe, and that fear of Rabbi Teitz, and that fear of the 50s into the 60s, when the whole concept of Erev in the Western world was shockingly new and innovative, that fear is no longer here. The point that children grow up with an Erev, you purchase Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata. Right there in Shmirat Shabbat Kehilchata, any kid who's going to spend hours learning about Bishul on Yontif and Bishul on Shabbat and what you can do and what you can't do, and that same Shmirat Kehilchata, Shabbat Kehilchata by Rabbi Norworth, which has universal acceptance today, you have endless material on Arba Rishiyot b'Shabbat, where you can carry, where you can't carry, endless material, voluminous, wonderful footnotes on putting up a Erev. So it's fascinating what was uncovered, what evolved from that one publicity. One other and final comment on Chabad, and also you'll find it in the bloggers. What do you mean Crown Heights can't have an Erev? Who says Crown Heights is a Reshut HaRab in the Oraita? And you see, right here, the machloket that we saw about Manhattan, we saw about Brooklyn, we saw previously, right here, the machloket begins again. Eastern Parkway, how many of you have been to Eastern Parkway? Sam, have you been to Eastern Parkway? You know what I'm talking about? Eastern Parkway, tremendously wide, lanes here, local lane, speed lane, speed lane, local lane, tremendously wide. Of course, I have to tell you, Eastern Parkway, if there ever was a mechitza on either side of Eastern Parkway, just look at the buildings. If you take the Chazon Ish's viewpoint, you don't have a problem at all. But let's forget about that viewpoint. Do 600,000 people really go by every day? And here you already have the machloket right here. Here, this person writes in, I say, look at Grand Heights. Between Eastern Parkway, Empire Boulevard, and the avenues, can anyone seriously think that there are less than 600,000 people that pass through these portions of Crown Heights? Then you have another blogger, 600,000? Absolutely not. It's more like 60,000. And this other blogger knows how to learn. He says, and don't repeat Reb Moshe to me, because Reb Moshe hold that if in one part of Brooklyn you have 600,000, you can't make an Erev anywhere in Brooklyn. He says, even Reb Moshe recognized that he was an utter dat yachid on this matter. And finally, at the end, the blogger says, the whole problem with Erev, only Reb Moshe Feinstein, Reb Aaron Cutler, again, notice the name Reb Aaron Cutler, even in Hasidic Chabad circles, were against it. The Rebbe's answer was to make it, but to make it seriously. So, my dear students, it's a fascinating topic, what we just scratched the surface. You can go on and on. Where do we draw the line? What do we mean times have changed? What do we mean halacha is the Dvar Hashem eternal? And you can go on and on. A person walks into the classroom and he'll say, Rakefet, and I've been called, you know, Rabbi Bednash calls me the Haredi member of the Gris faculty. I'm proud to say when it comes to Psak Halacha, I am Haredi, I'm a Talmud of the Rav. You're right, I'm probably more Machmir than most, if I can use the term Machmir, but all right, I will accept that title as a badge of honor. I knew the Rav intimately, and it's to have known the Rav was to latch on to brisk, to velushin, to all that came before. But what does it mean times have changed? Rakefet, you're opposed to partnership minyanim. You're opposed to this attitude that homosexuality we should be much more condescending and then much more accepting and not be so strident, etc., etc. And yet, take a look at yourself. You went to college, and you went to university, and you went to graduate school, and you have secular degrees, and echvesi, you watch television. I don't know when I watch television last, but at least in theory, I'm not opposed to television. It's just to waste time. And then look at the way you dress. Where's your bekesher, and where's your gatel, and where's your beard, and where's your prayers, and where's a proper kippah? Times have changed. Where do you draw the line? And this is the delicate issue that we all struggle with. And I don't have to tell you, the bloggers raised a fabulous issue. To solve it can't be solved overnight and can't be solved black and white. It has to be solved by your lifestyle. The Dvar Hashem zu halacha. And when it comes to the halachic framework, there we must surrender. We must accept. We cannot innovate to balance the halacha with modern trends. Shem Yirachem, what happened to the Jewish people when we used the concept vis-a-vis halacha, times have changed. On the other hand, the point that blogger makes about Melbourne and the air of never falling down is a very valid point. And Ein Hachinami, it could be today that if the Lubavitcher Rebbe would deal with the Erev problem, they would whisper in his ear, those people who deal with the Erev, and let's take Melbourne again as the example, Rebbe, the Erev has been up 20 years, there was not one Shabbat where the Erev went down. I know in Yerushalayim they strengthened the Erev, I was told this by people from within, and as far as I know, in the last two snowstorms, the Erev did not fall down at all. So, you understand, technology and improvement and the kalim that we work with, the utensils, the tools. Do you ever see the Erev truck in Yerushalayim? It has ladders. It looks like like a truck climbing up to correct electricity, to fix poles, to fix wires. They have the equipment. They can do a first-rate job. So I don't know, unless it's mamish maim sheinuch himself, unless it's a ruach sheinu mitzuya that's beyond our comprehension, the Erev today stands and withstands. To check, in Chutz Laretz, I know I've seen shuls with ramzarim, traffic lights. The Erev is up, the light is green. The Erev is down, the light is red. I've never seen the light red. I've always seen the light green. I know with these phone calls, automatic phone calls, which to me are a pain in the neck, gentlemen, to me it's a pain in the neck because it bothers you. You get phone calls, but I know when at my wife's sister's house in Hillcrest, all the time there are phone calls, generally not of a happy nature, informing you of the shiver in the community. And Erev Shabbos, you get a phone call with all the pertinent information, and the Erev is up. So, Baruch Hashem, it could be that particular part of the problem we have solved. Okay, now I want to show you a document that is, again, worthy of a master's thesis. And I thank my virtual Talmud, Ilan Riza, from, I believe it is, Washington Heights. He has an interesting background. He has many different types of Jewish blood in him. Part of it is German, Yekki, but many other types flow in his veins. And he called my attention to an article that appeared in the February 1962 Harpades. I would imagine that Harpades is online, and you may want to look it up. Let me tell you what Harpades is. Let me not take for granted you know what I'm talking about. I have students who yet published a Divrei Torah in Harpades. Rabbi Dratch, Mark Dratch, published in Harpades. If I'm not mistaken, it was in the 70s, I believe, or the early 80s, Mark published in Harpades. Harpades in America, Harpades was a private rabbinic journal. What I mean by a private rabbinic journal? You have, for the sake of argument, tradition. Tradition is not private. It's a journal run by the Rabbinical Council of America, and anyone could submit an article. And if they read the article and feel it's worthy, they will publish it. And tradition has had many fabulous articles over the generations. Harpades was owned by Harav Pades. He established it. I believe his first name was Aaron Pades. But he established it. It was called Harpades. It's a play on his name and a play on words. And it was a very fine rabbinic journal. It made money by the advertisements it accepted. Those of you familiar with the machlokas over kogel, over kosher gelatin, that machloket was fought out in Harpades in the 30s and to the 40s. There were endless advertisements in there. I can just see the kogel advertisement in front of my eyes. And they always gave news about weddings, about happenings in the Torah community. I imagine people paid money to put in, if you weren't Rabbi Soloveitchik or a place with Moshe Feinstein, and you wanted to put in about your family wedding, it also a source of income for the editor. That Harpades later was bought by Rav Simcha Elberg, if I'm not mistaken, and he continued to edit it and publish it for many, many years. I don't believe it's published anymore. You can correct me if I'm wrong. And it's a very valuable collection, not just for Divrei Torah and Psak Halacha, but if you want to get an insight, an overlook, what American Orthodoxy, American Torah was about, Harpades is an excellent journal. Now, what makes this quote, what I'm about to quote to you, so interesting, is the author, Rabbi Shimon Schwab. Rabbi Shimon Schwab, as you know, again, a few words of background. The German Jews who came to America originally all were Reformed, all became Reformed. And even when you had someone like Jacob Schiff, who was raised on the lap of Rabbi Shimon Schwab, Paul Hirsch, and raised on Torah Derech Eretz, You have Jacob Schiff becomes a billionaire in the United States, and he becomes the president of Temple Emanuel. And that was the story. And Jacob Schiff remained a hybrid. His home was kosher. He washed, he benched. He there's the famous story that one morning they see this beautiful carriage, a horse-drawn carriage parked outside the Beis Medrash HaGadol on Norfolk Avenue on the east side. You follow me, Avram? And what billionaire is davening there? They go in, and there's Jacob Schiff davening from Amit and saying Kaddish, and they say to him, Mr. Schiff, what are you doing here on the Lower East Side? You're president of Temple Emanuel. And he answers, I have yahrzeit for my mother today. I should hold the yahrzeit in Temple Emanuel. So you see, he always remained. We spoke about him, I think, 2 years ago in class. We spoke about him. He's a very fascinating individual. His daughter, Dorothy Schiff, was the owner and publisher of the New York Post. When I was growing up, Dorothy Schiff was the owner and publisher of the New York Post.
So why did he want to be part of Temple Emanuel?
That's what America, Alex, America, the melting pot. The core hachituch bi'evrit. You become, you Americanized. You became part of
the
times. Times have changed. You spoke English. You didn't speak English with an accent anymore. You understand that. And when you carried $1 million in your pocket, you didn't have to speak any language. Money spoke. So then the German Jews, and of course I've said this many times, and if you don't understand it, you can't understand the history of Torah in America. In World War II, anyone who came to America, Moshe, please stand by the door and don't let anyone else out. We have exactly a minion left, and this week and next week are the last times we can daven Baruch in class. After that, we join America. America today is on daylight savings time. Snow is falling. No one can get out of their house, no Matanet Levyonim, no Mishloach Monot, but Baruch Hashem, they're on daylight savings time. How you can have daylight savings time with snow on the ground, that's a different story, but we'll leave that for the New York Times to deal with. So before World War II, there was a great change that happened. In World War II, anyone who came to America knew they were taking the risk that their children would be Goyim. And my family is a perfect example. They once asked my grandmother, who was at Sadeket. I never knew her. She died when I was a year and a half. But I'm told by people, I mean, we had the mum, if you know Josh Daniel, the dentist, his great-grandmother was the Sadeket of our family. The only home she ate in was her niece's home, was my grandmother's home. So they once asked my grandmother, this is what I'm told, my father used to tell me this, how do you feel raising children in America? And they say, gain vigoyim. And you know, they throw away this, throw away that. And my grandmother answered, the Ribbono Shlom takes care of the goyim, so he'll take care of my children too. That was the attitude. By the mid-30s, if you came to America, when did your parents get to America? It's
September 38th.
Okay. By the mid-30s, if you came to America, you didn't come because you wanted to. You came running away to save your life. And many of these people came with dedication. They're going to show, as the Lubavitcher Rebbe said, the sixth Rebbe, American is nicht anders, is no different than the old home. Now, Yekis started to pour in to Washington Heights in particular. And they did something very brilliant. Two very famous German rabbis came to America at that time. One was Rabbi Hoffman, I believe his first name was Jacob Hoffman, and the other one was Rabbi Yosef Breuer. Rabbi Jacob Hoffman became rabbi where your father is rabbi, of Ohed Tzedek. It was originally a Hungarian congregation with German overtones. He became the Rav there, had tremendous achmas nefesh, really never acclimated to America.
He almost got arrested.
He had a tremendous, with what, the wine?
With
what? With what? I can't. Would Birkat Hachama
him
as well?
They had him to Central Park.
Oh,
and he didn't know what was happening, and the police, like, he didn't speak English.
The police almost arrested. I almost got arrested too, burning chametz in the Bronx, until a Jewish policeman explained to the Irishman what we were doing. Today in Brooklyn, and probably Queens, the police, their sanitation brings a big what do you call them, urns where you can burn the chametz without a problem. In Israel, it's the same thing, but all right, Israel's Israel. So Rabbi Jacob Hoffman goes to Ab Tzedek, and his nephew, Yonah Bamel, Zeichet Tzadik Levrach, whose son never came back from 82, one of the greatest people I've ever met in my life, Yonah Bamel. So Yonah Bamel told me, even when he could speak a little English, but Yonah said to me, a chesped for Joe DiMaggio he could never give. And then he came in Aliyah, came to Israel, and that was the end of America. In Oeb Tzedek, I'm sure, outside of a history bug, no one even knows the name today. Okay, that's the nature of life. That was Yonah Bamel. That was Rabbi Jacob Hoffman. Rabbi Yosef Breuer came, saved by Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel, and the Yekkes did something ingenious. Instead of subjecting their rabbi to an American environment, to an American congregation, to a bunch of Yankees, they built a shul around Rabbi Breuer. Tehillat Adat Yeshurun. And that's the secret. He, totally successful on the American scene, not as American, not Americanizing, not dealing with American balabatim. Totally successful that he recreated within the American context a Zeran pin of what was in Germany, what was in Frankfurt. And he succeeded. A day school, Breuer's, as it was popularly called, a mikveh, what he didn't build, high schools, shrita, hashgacha, and spoken German. His letters to the shul, I have some of them, until the 60s, they were in German, not in English. This was Rabbi Breuer, and he built the German community. Did you want to say something, Moshe? I see your hand up.
OZ was created for Americans.
Well, I can't just saying who.
Is an American
shul. Yeah, you know, I understand that. That's what I'm saying. That's not a problem. The reality was that Rabbi Hoffman, they went and placed into an American framework. All right, he was well known, he was a good speaker, but all this was in German. It was in a different context. Rabbi Breuer, they built Germany for him in Washington Heights. Ultimately, that Germany Americanizes, but it Americanizes at its pace. It was not forced upon the rabbi. That's exactly my point. It's a very important point that I just made. And if you understand that, you can understand why these two great rabbanim had such different experiences on the American scene. Now, a lot has been written about them. There's a doctorate done on Rabbi Hoffman. It's come out in a book, I believe, published by Barry Lam. I taught Rabbi Hoffman's grandson right here in BMT in the early 70s. A fabulous book was written about Rabbi Breuer, published by Feldheim. It's by Rabbi, one of the, I think it's co-authored, but Landesman is one of the authors. It's a fabulous volume. It's a world you can go into. When Rabbi Breuer died, there was the whole question of secession. And Rabbi Shwin Schwab comes on the scene. Now Rabbi Shwin Schwab, his story in America is fascinating. He also was the Yekka, as you all know from my Monday classes, at least last year. We spent many, many shurim on him. He studied in the Litvishi Yeshivat. So you have a Yekki who had deep connections to the Litvisha world. He comes to Baltimore in the shul he comes to, which was one of the Orthodox shuls in Baltimore. There was mixed dancing, there was social dancing. He had all the problems that an American Rav has, but he was young enough to acclimate, to succeed, to build. And he established a wonderful reputation in Baltimore. He was one of the first Rabbanim in Baltimore to really change the tide and change what was going on the ground. And he was a natural to become the assistant to Rabbi Breuer, and then, of course, the Rav of the German Kehillah.
Was that before the establishment of Nei Yisrael?
No, Nei Yisrael was already there in Baltimore when Rabbi Schwab got there. Nei Yisrael goes to Baltimore in the 30s. Rabbi Schwab gets there a little bit, if I'm not mistaken, a year or two after Nei Yisrael takes roots in Baltimore. But when Rabbi Schwab was there, Nei Yisrael did not yet dominate the city like it dominates it today. Now, Rabbi Schwab deals with this exact problem of Eruv in Manhattan. And what's fascinating about his article in HaPrades is he gives you a very insightful description of what was going on in America at that time. And basically, he's dealing, what happened in HaPrades was Rav Menachem Kasher, the person who was pushing more than anyone else, or among the biggest Gedolim pushing for the Eruv in Manhattan, was Rav Menachem Kasher. We've spoken about Rav Menachem Kasher last year. He was a Gaon Adir. All of you are familiar with Rav Menachem Kasher through the Torah Shleima, through the Divrei Menachem. He was a Gera Chassid. Being a Chassid, he came from a tradition of building an Eruv. Manhattan, of course, was much easier because it's an island. And I need not tell you, we spoke about this a year ago in great detail, that once you're surrounded by water on at least three sides, and perhaps even part of a fourth side, then you, lachatchila, may already have a built-in Eruv, a built-in island, water on all sides, steep cliffs, etc., etc., fences to protect people from falling into the water. So Rav Menachem Kasher was pushing for an Eruv. HaPrades opened its issues, its journal, to Rav Menachem Kasher. Rabbi Schwab, by the early 60s, is a well-known figure. And he writes a letter to the editor, to Rabbi Prades, and he explains why he's opposed to an Eruv. And he says, how can you consider building an Eruv in Manhattan today? We have Amharatzit all over. People don't know what Yiddishkeit is about. And they go out of their way to destroy all that is holy. He refers to the situation in New York City, Chedim Ruchani. It is a massive spiritual disaster. And you're going to build an Eruv? He says, what is going to happen? You're going to build an Eruv? People will just look upon it as another lenient decision. And they're going to continue carrying, muksa. They're going to say, once you're permitted to carry, you can carry everything. And even though you will tell me that the rabbis have to speak up, the rabbis have to talk, the rabbis have to explain, no matter what language the rabbis will explain what the Eruv is and what the limitations are and that you can't carry muksa, no matter what the rabbis will explain, they, the masses, will not listen. You're sitting? Watch. And he says, what is the greatest proof to this? What happened these last few years in 1956? When the greatest Rabbanim in the United States, the 11 most famous Russian yeshiva issued a psak against mixed board of rabbis and synagogue council. Who listens? Who fell into line? And this was explained in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in English, in every language that the people understand. And no one has heeded it. And gentlemen, here you have right away what he's alluding to is this tremendous chasm, this tremendous cleavage that's starting to develop in the United States, in New York. New York is the heart of Yiddish Judaism in America. What happens in New York ultimately happens everywhere else. Before World War II, yeshivas of Yitzchok Chanan, Taylor Vedas, Chaim Berlin might have had differences, but they all respected each other. There was constant social relations. Students could move back and forth. Even faculty members moved back and forth. By the mid-50s, when you have that psak of the Russia yeshiva, there is a new orthodoxy in America. Right wing, you can call it. Call it what you wish. A dominant, a non-compromising Torah viewpoint. A loud, vociferous Torah viewpoint. Rabbi Aaron Cutler feared nobody. When he had to take some course on or some concept on, he took the Lubavitcher Rebbe on. That already is ancient history by the mid-50s. Took Lubavitcher on. You all know, we spoke about it many times in many different contexts. Rabbi Aaron feared nobody. And now the Russia yeshiva, Rabbi Moshe was a more edler person, a different type of personality. But Rabbi Aaron, she went along. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, certainly a different type of ishiyut. He went along. Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner has gone through a long process. Read for Hillel Goldberg's biography of Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner. It's excellent. It's fabulous. You know, a long process. A Talmud of Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak, a Kohen Cook, and years later, he takes his Rebbe's picture off the wall. Something that disturbs me until today. Although I have to say, when I met in person Professor Halivni Weiss the other Shabbat a few weeks ago, I told Professor Halivni Weiss, your autobiography gave me back new respect for Rav Kutner. And he knew what I was saying. He knew exactly what I was saying. I taught his son, he knows me. Ephraim was studying this kollel, Ephraim, Dr. Ephraim Halivni Weiss. And because when Halivni Weiss survived the camp, survived the hell, and he finally reaches America and he goes to Chaim Berlin. He had nowhere to go, this poor kid, no relatives. And Rabbi Kutner saw the clothes he was wearing, took him to a clothing store and bought him his first suit in the United States. I said, you gave me back new respect for Rabbi Kutner. I knew Rabbi Kutner well. His cousin was my neighbor till the day he died. Rabbi Yeshua Kutner lived in Rabbi Chaim Berlin 18. Yomo, you think I live in a Presta building? What's the matter with you? This is the KGB has to wave and check you out before you can buy into Rabbi Chaim Berlin 18. And I'm not joking. Rabbi Kutner, I used to take Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner up in the elevator, Rafi, to visit his cousin. You understand? I don't want to tell you more, or you'll be upset. I don't know where you're coming from, but I can only tell you a certain article Rabbi Yitzchak Kutner wrote. Rabbi Yehoshua Kutner threw it on the floor and stomped on it and spat on it and went berserk. And I said, I helped him, what can I tell you? Okay, I helped Rabbi Yehoshua Kutner, not Rabbi Yitzchak. That article is on the one on the Holocaust caused by the Zionists. You're not familiar with that? Jewish Observer, that article. Oh my gosh. Whew! But anyway, America's changed. And he makes the analogy. Who wants the Arab? The modern rabbis, the YU rabbis. Rabbi Kasher was identified with YU, was very close to Reb Shmuel Belkin. He was involved with YU. He was a very open person. This was his ballpark. Who wants the Erev? The rabbis in Manhattan. Who are they? RCA men. Who are RCA men? Board of Rabbis, Synagogue Council, Reform, Conservative, all mechitzat, all barriers have crashed, have fallen down. Who wants the Erev? They're going to listen, they're going to observe, their balabatim are going to pay attention. You can speak English, you can speak Yiddish, you can speak Hebrew. It will not help. And he probably said it in German as well. And finally, I can't end off with the whole, you'll see next week, it's unbelievable what he says. Part of it is very true afterwards, but this part is very fascinating. And then he says, and the women are going to listen to us, and here he uses the word, you got to be able to understand what he's saying, pocketbooks. You understand? Why do you take the shul on Shabbos? My wife will never take a pocketbook on principle because that's vachadek. She has a special Shabbos, a little beautiful bag with her sitter in there. You know, she dabbins in a shul where they're not enough siddurim to go around standing. It's a shul, they daven all day. It's yakai. I don't know, I go out of my mind. I go to shul 6:30, by 8 o'clock I want to be home making kiddush. By 8:20 I want to be sitting with a Gemara, a Rambam, and going to my world. But there are people who love to daven. This Shabbos she came back, I don't know, after 12 o'clock she was inspired, walking on air, the rabbi junior, it's a whole family of rabbis, English people, Yakar, Rosen, that they daven, they sing every word. Their mother's my student, Gilad Radistoffer, from the west side, Moshe, from the west side, Rabbi Shalalem. He says, the ladies with the pocketbooks, when they're walking, and he's describing this, I'm quoting him, they're walking across the bridge from the Manhattan to the Bronx. The Bronx, there's no Erev. What are they going to do? Throw their pocketbooks away? They're going to carry the pocketbooks right into the Bronx. He says, who's going to listen? Chas v'chalila, in this generation, when they don't know enough about synagogue council and board of rabbis, who's going to listen when you tell them you cannot carry a pocketbook across the Willis Avenue Bridge from Manhattan into the Bronx? Wow, fascinating. Gentlemen, to reiterate, we're not finished. The best is yet to come, but what he comes next is a problem we have at this very moment, in this very classroom, this very Rebbe suffers from it, halacha lemaisa. So what do we do today, all right? The Lubavitcher Rebbe, no question about it, that he felt you could build an Erev, but la halacha he was opposed for many reasons, and that's why he said, build it clandestinely, don't let the world know. If you can build an Erev clandestinely, I have my doubts, but then you get involved with the whole problem. How could Lubavitch change? This is not Rabbi Schechter, this is not Rabbi Lichtenstein. These are Hasidim, and by definition, a Chassid has to follow the Rebbe. And imagine one blogger had the nerve to say, times have changed. And that's an interesting discussion. Then we got involved with Rabbi Schwab, and he too sounds very much like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, extraneous reasons. Well, you'll see at the end he agrees with the Rebbe. Extraneous reasons.
He agrees with the Rebbe.
You'll see
he
next week.
He says you can do it.
Next week you will see. Next week. And extraneous reasons why he's opposed. But these extraneous reasons give us a very beautiful periscope to look in and see what's going on in America 1959, 1960, 1961. Tomorrow, Be'ezrat Hashem, we pick off exactly where we left off. I wouldn't miss the Shiurim for all the Shalach Manat in America that's rotting away because they couldn't get through the snow to deliver it. We pick up with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Yeah, 1 second.
Does anybody ever make an index to how far they, let's say someone wants to do scholarly research?
To the best of my knowledge, no, but there may be a search engine that you have to check. Moshe, you wanted the picture of the Chafetz Chaim? Pass that back to Moshe, please. I have one more picture of the Chafetz Chaim. If anyone wants it, it's yours.
But you know, that picture shows the greatness of the Jewish people. Here is a short man.
Right.
And he's surrounded by these tall characters.
Right.
And they all show their respect.
And the whole world is looking at him. And here we see this movie. I shake. I shiver. I put it on my permanent, I start it, whatever word you would use. Whenever I want to get a little chizuk, I look at it. Now, I want to tell you, I had a lot of chizuk. Let me share with you. You look at this picture and you wonder, what's the connection of Rakefet to this picture? No? What do you say?
What's the picture?
That's the Prime Minister giving the head of the Congress, Boma, a Megillah illustrated, beautiful illustration. I want you all to know that the person who did the illustration is Avraham Barashevsky, who born and raised in Russia, Leningrad Institute of Art, came to Israel, studied at Shvut Ami, which Aaron Rakefet helped to organize, and here you have a Shvut Ami graduate who is responsible for that beautiful Megillah that our Prime Minister is giving to the chairman or whatever of the Congress. I want to thank Moshe Schwartz. He sent me a link and it's very fascinating. A Lakewood boy came in Aliyah. And you should tell the class about it, Moshe, if anyone wants it. And this Lakewood boy was told by his friends in Lakewood, you're not allowed to go in Aliyah bisman hazeh, only when Mashiach comes. And he went over to Reb Chaim Kanievsky, and it's videoed. And he's asking Reb Chaim, did he do the right thing? Is there a mitzvah? What he was told in Lakewood. Reb Chaim looks at him like he's crazy. He says, betach, it's a mitzvah, do you write a mitzvah la'alot ta'atza? And Reb Chaim gives him that answer, and he repeats it. The guy can't believe what he's hearing. I hope that in Lakewood they're seeing the video clippage of Reb Chaim Kanievsky. The Kanievskys are, it's a different world than B'nai Brak. Yerushalayim versus B'nai Brak. It's in the news all the time, and it is a different world. My dear student, in B'nai Brak, they are grounded in modern-day Israel, and they know what's going on, and they're part of it, and they have a very different attitude. If you're going to learn, you learn, and if you're not learning, you have to go into the army. In Yerushalayim, Rav Shmuel Orbach, he's living, they're floating in the air. It's Yerushalayim Shomala. They are not grounded in Yerushalayim Shomata. You follow? That is the difference, all right? Gotta give it time. I don't believe in forcing. I don't believe in yelling, shouting. Give it time. You can't force everyone into one mold, but little by little, we will merge and bridge Yerushalayim and B'nai Brak and Yerushalayim Shomala with Yerushalayim Shomata. Gentlemen, ready to daven. Where's the Baal Tefillah here? Adam, Bevakasha, Sidurim, and Yerushalayim.